May it please the court. This discipline case involves an attorney with no previous discipline who faces two unrelated yet troubling allegations. The first involves her insistence to her staff to bring in $20,000 in 9 days by hanging out at the courthouse and offering a smile to lost people who appear to be representing themselves, to tell them she would give them free advice. The plan, as she called it, was that those people would follow the staff back to the office where they will give us money.
Now, it seemed like a unique marketing strategy on her part, but I didn't see where anyone was harmed, although the profession could have been harmed by the second claim, the one about not giving over the file unless they paid over, what was it, $1,800 or $1,600? Is that a usual practice that people are showing? Well, it is a usual practice if you're going to copy a file. You have to pay for the copying, but is that a usual practice on these return of documents? Do you expect to get paid the whatever it is before and review the file before you give it back?
As to your first point, Your Honor, it's true. We don't have very many of these courthouse solicitation cases. There were a bunch back in the 50s and 60s. There are reported decisions that the court can look at from those days that are interesting cases, for one thing.
Of course, we also had English chasing, and we also had...
Right, but we don't see as many as those, fortunately. Either we're not hearing about them or they're not happening, and that's a good thing. But as to the second matter, we do get complaints of lawyers who delay in returning their files.
How about charging them to return the file?
Well, as it turns out, that initially happened in this case. There's an informal opinion saying that lawyers shouldn't do that. But that's not actually part of the charge in this case. I think it aggravates because that was the first response when the file was finally provided was to show 8 hours of work and copying charges, and even apparently pulling out it looks like there was an attempt to pull out work product. A work product may be protected from the opponent, but it obviously shouldn't be protected from the client, because this court, the advisory committee in formal opinion 115 said cover to cover, the file belongs to the client. The court adopted that in the first couple's decision in 1997. So that it is bothersome. Those cases are, frankly, often they come to us if there's just single incident, no prior discipline. We call the lawyer back and say, give the file back. And they give the file back. And that often resolves those. When that doesn't happen as quickly as we think it should, then a lot of those cases result in admonition. They also have come before the court, and reprimands have been imposed when the file is held hostage, for instance, for a fee. And they have occurred. So that violation has appeared before the court before. I think this is one of the worst types of that particular violation.
So which one? Did you call them and say, give the file back, and they didn't give it back? Did you?
What in this case?
In this case?
Well, I don't know exactly how it came in. But we had the other... I actually think the other case came in first, and this one was the solicitation case was in the hopper, so to speak.
There was a complaint by someone in her office, right?
Yes.
A complaint was filed by someone in her office.
Yes, on the solicitation case, it was a report by a former staffer saying this is the email that we saw.
And so what do you think is the most serious violation in this case?
Together is the issue if we're talking about sanction. I mean, I could argue both of them are pretty serious. One of the solicitation is offensive to the profession, but that really isn't why it's problematic. I mean, a lot of us would think, well, that shouldn't be done. That sounds awful. The issue is that the clients are, that the prospective clients, the targets, are, this is what the U.S. Supreme Court has said and what this court's comment to that rule says. It talks about that the problem is that prospective clients, aren't ready to see this kind of thing, and they're put at a great disadvantage of undue influence. There, it's fraught with the possibility of undue influence, intimidation, and overreaching.
But your respondent testifier states that it never actually took place, that certainly the email went out,
right,
but no solicitation ever occurred. None of the staff ever went over to the courthouse and did this.
That is true. It appears that, that is the case, that nobody actually went to the courthouse and hung out and tried to do these things. That shouldn't matter. I mean, for a couple of reasons. One, Rule 8.4A says that lawyers can't try to do through someone else something that they can't do themselves, and she's charged with that here. It also says that lawyers can't attempt to violate the rules, which is what the email appears to be. It was retracted only weeks later, after she understood that the complaint.
You cite to Woodward, right, and
yes.
Downs, two
yes.
Very clear cases about the evils of the solicitation violation. What were the disciplines in those cases?
I think both of them were either a long suspension or a disbarment, I believe.
And
that's right.
So why is it then that the recommendation of the argument here is for a suspended suspension?
I think that, frankly, I think that if the court isn't convinced that the respondent understands that this is unacceptable, an actual suspension would be appropriate. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons we're here is to find that out.
So if we don't suspend, we're saying it's acceptable.
Well, I
mean, you say if
you mean if you don't actually suspend? No. The point is
acceptable.
My point is whether the court is convinced that the respondent accepts that her conduct is misconduct and is serious misconduct.
That's an argument you make when it's here on a stipulated discipline, and that's not the posture that we're in, right?
No, we're not in that posture.
So, I mean, but I've heard that argument made in that posture.
Right.
Because it's stipulated, there's an acknowledgement and the recognition by the respondent of the seriousness of the charge. Why would we draw that inference here?
I don't think you can for me. You may be able to from the respondents, from the argument today. I mean, from our position, we don't see it yet, but we did agree that a state suspension could be appropriate. There's no priors. 1987 case, I think it's 87, where the court did reprimand a lawyer for going to a hospital. It's not in the brief, but it's the Crouppen case that is a reported decision from they say 87. Yes.
What do you get from probation? I mean, I understand probation if someone's on drugs or alcohol or you're monitoring it to make sure, whatever. What do you get from probation here? That they won't go out and solicit clients at the courthouse again?
They won't
send an email out again? What do you get from probation? This is an instance of violating the rules. Where's probation get you? That they drive while drunk, then they get suspended or they have some other thing happen? What do you get from probation?
We would hope and that the monitoring, including reporting, you know, that education, specific education to advertising issues, and having a mentor, law practice management mentor, going to ethics school, attending the solo small firm conference, specific
She had very little experience in civil matters. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know that, Your Honor. I think
wasn't it a new civil practice or fairly new civil practice?
I think
is that why you think a monitor or mentor would be useful?
I mean, I think there are a lot of lawyers that a monitor or mentor could be helpful. I mean, there are a lot of lawyers that need help with law practice management because they just do. I mean, we don't have as much mentoring as we did 30 years ago, and it's unfortunate, and so people are out on their own.
But some of the stuff, and this may be off the track here, but when you talk about the trust account, I don't know what a mentor says. You don't take your client's money to pay your groceries. I mean, how clear can that be? I mean, you have an account that says banks, now you have more than one bank account. You have an account that's my personal account, business account, and an account that's your client's account, trust account. how complicated that can that be? Do you have to have solo practice and mentoring and take ethics counsel? And it's just this is a simple deal. I mean, you go on probation. Do you have a separate account? You take your client's money to buy your groceries. This is not hard to figure.
I understand.
And you can't cure bad judgment.
I'm sorry. Well, right, the risks are great in those situations when it's, as I think the experts call it, when it's characterological. But I don't know that that's what we have here. I mean, we don't have a history of known misconduct.
Is it your considered view, further answering the question, what kinds of cases is probation appropriate for? Why do you believe that would ensure that nothing happened to hurt clients again?
Well, ensure is a big word, but yes, that our goal would be, we do believe that probation can help in a lot of cases. Frankly, it's worked, is one of the reasons we say that. I mean, if we look at our numbers, and more often than not, I think I'm right on that, often enough that we're comfortable with it, that it has been successful for a certain number of years, and we have fewer violations of people who are on probation than without. Whether it's an actual suspension, obviously, would work too, because it removes the lawyer from the practice and protects the clients that way. But things where it could be that it seemed like a great marketing strategy to her, and as Judge Teitelman mentioned, instead of a violation of the rules that I'm gonna violate anyway.
Is it a violation of the rules to be at the courthouse and pass out your card?
Comes pretty close. I don't know that we've seen that particular case that I can think of. I mean, if it's purely handing out a card and not saying anything else, but if you know that the person needs legal services, then I think that might come pretty close as well.
And tell me why you think it is.
Well, because the idea is that the prospect, the target, is subject to undue influence. And isn't.
If they're at a courthouse where we know they are there because they have legal work, and the question is it that you walk up to them and hand them a card without them asking you if you're a lawyer? I guess my issue is, in looking at what was said, a part of what's offensive is you tell them you're going to give them free legal advice and take them back to the office with no intention to give them free legal advice. So is that what it is, or it's that you talk to them at all and tell them you know someone who can give them legal assistance?
Well, the email made it more offensive, certainly, by saying, you know, here's your reason for doing this, so that they'll come back and give us money. If the purpose is to solicit business one way or another, and you're dealing with people who are known to need legal advice and they're not represented, or I suppose even if you know that they are represented, then it is a violation, I would think.
And what is the wording of the rule that it violates? What does the rule say? That
says a lawyer may not initiate the in-person solicitation of legal business under any circumstance other than with an existing or former client, lawyer, close friend, or relative. Okay.
So my question is, if they come up to you and ask if you're a lawyer, is it okay to then give them a card versus you just find people in the courthouse and go up to them and give them one?
I think, right, and I'm sorry, I misunderstood if that was what you asked the first time. I think if the lawyer or the lawyer's agent initiates anything, it puts it in a different status than if the client says, you have a suit, are you a lawyer? I need a lawyer. I think that probably is a little bit different.
Indirect.
Here, the email says, if you see someone who looks lost, ask them if you know what they need.
Right.
And then anticipates they will ask you, are you a lawyer? And you go from there.
Right. And I think if her argument is that therefore she didn't know they needed a lawyer, that's some serious bootstrapping, because that was her goal, is to find out whether they need a lawyer, to initiate the conversation, say, do you need a lawyer, and why do you need a lawyer? I can help. Well, as soon as she knew that they needed a lawyer, then she was soliciting, even if she wasn't at the initial question. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. What we have here is a tale of no conduct. In count one, an email was sent. Nobody did anything in response to that email. No solicitations were made.
It doesn't say that they have to. I mean, the rule was quoted, well, and it says an attempt to.
I'm aware of that, but I don't even think it rises to the level of an attempt. If you have cases like Woodward and Downs, I know the black letter says that no attempt is required, that just the intent and expressing that intent and trying to get somebody else to do it is required. But in Woodward and Downs, there's 30 examples of prohibited solicitations. So the court says in one case we don't need any examples of solicitations, and then there's 10 in Downs and 18 or 19 in Woodward's.
From reading your brief as your respondent, it's not clear to me that your client understands now that this was inappropriate and that she wouldn't just think she can do it again. She says she was simply being an example of networking and being an approachable, decent person.
Well, no, I think it's crystal clear that I guarantee you she knows. I guarantee you she knows that she's here. This has been a great expense to her. It's been a tremendous effort to her. She's had to retain me to come here, and I guarantee you that we won't see this. Matter of fact, I'll get to the last part of the speech first. We know she won't do this because after this complaint was made, she called Mr. Pratzel. She engaged in the law practice management class that they say that she should. So she did that class with
him. She cooperated with OCDC?
Yes, right. Yes, and she's already remediated it. My last point is probation isn't necessary because she put herself on probation years ago. She's already fixed these issues, and they are fixed. We aren't having these problems anymore. But to go back to counsel.
Does she still think that what she was doing is protected speech?
Pardon me?
Does she still take the position that what she did is protected speech under our Constitution and the United States Constitution?
I think I take that position, Judge. I think that it is, and I'll tell you why. That it does not rise to the level of a solicitation is why. If it were solicitations, the cases are clear that the court has the ability to regulate solicitations. But there's no solicitation here. I think what really the email is saying is be nice to people and invite a request for a solicitation ultimately.
It says a lot more than that.
Well, it does, but I have the benefit
well,
of knowing this more than you
it,
do.
Have them come back here under the guise that you tell them they'll get free legal advice when we have no intention of giving them free legal advice. They love you and follow you to the office where they will proceed to give us money. Well, so isn't that that is very hard to defend under right to free speech?
I don't think she was planning on holding a gun to anybody's head back.
But isn't that conduct instead of just speech?
Well, in this case, we just have an email and nobody was solicited at all.
Because her secretary quit and reported it.
Well, and because the other lawyer didn't take her seriously, there's a letter in our appendix from him saying we didn't think she meant to
but
do that.
Is your client going to, that go back to my question, given your position here, are you saying that she can do this next week and that's what she may do and we should assume she will?
I assure you that she will never do it again. It may be on the outer limits of free speech right up there on that line next to the rule, but it's the outer limits.
How far is this different from a law firm where they hire law review people who have no personalities. Law review people do have personalities. And they send them out to the Chamber of Commerce. They send them out to the clubs. And they say, get me business. We want you to generate business. Well, if you don't generate business, you don't have a job. How much is this different from that?
Well, first of all, the people who received this email didn't think that their jobs were at risk. The one lady who quit, she made this bar complaint after her unemployment compensation was denied. And this was not her primary complaint. I believe that's also in the appendix. This was her last complaint. She didn't have anything to say about this that was significant. She was more upset about being billed out as $90 an hour as a paralegal than count one. So the difference is, in this case, it didn't happen, for starters. It get me business. I would liken this to the offer of general information. It is permissible for an attorney to give a free seminar. It's permissible to offer a free consultation. I do think discretion is the better part of valor, and should you even do things that are remotely like solicitation in the courthouse? No, of course not.
Well, we've chosen to discipline direct in-person solicitation, and we've allowed other types of advertisement, as tasteless as it may be to some people and some lawyers. But the rule clearly prohibits an attempt to directly solicit. Would you agree with that?
Well,
whether it violates, whether you and I can have a reasonable disagreement, is whether it violates free speech.
It only does it if you know that the person needs legal services. So if the person is not known to need legal services,
but she says go to the courthouse to find them because they might wander around looking lost.
Well, there's a disproportionate number of people who need legal services there, but they may be going to the clerk's office. They may have been subpoenaed. They may be there for. They may already have a lawyer. They may not need legal services. It doesn't know. But again, this is a hypothetical. Nobody was solicited. No one took this seriously. Anissa's staff knew she was a hothead. That's why they didn't take her seriously. They knew nobody was going to get fired, and nobody did get fired. And they didn't do this.
Well, so, what about the second issue?
The second issue with the file, I'm glad you brought that up. That file sat in Ms. Bluebaum's office and Anissa's office for months, waiting for Mr. Dunn to come pick it up. It was available for him on March
3rd. Did he have to pay to get it picked up?
Pardon me?
Did he have to pay to pick it up?
Oh, no. No. The only reason that the issue with the payment came about, Anissa had this associate, Dylan Bates, who was unaware that you don't charge a guy for the copy of the file when he's made a bar complaint.
If it was already prepared in March, why did Mr. Bates say he spent a lot of hours over 2 or 3 days putting it together in August, and that's why he tried to charge her?
They were going to give him the original. So the original file.
So it took 2 or 3 days to copy it?
Well, yeah, it was. I've
seen an attorney's
time. It was a banker's box full of stuff. Yeah, it took a good day at least, you know, to have it ready. You know, I don't know what the bill says, but the bill was retracted. And the bill that's really important in this case is the bill for $10,000 that Mr. Dunn never paid. The bar complaint in this case and the demand for the file was an effort for him to avoid his legal bill. He had pledged the property to Anissa, and he didn't want to give that property up. So instead of going to get his file and instead of going to court to face her motions to withdraw, where she destroyed the pledge, that's all in our appendix, by the way. That's all in the that's in the record. The destroyed pledge, the pledge agreement, that's all in there. So Mr. Dunn didn't want to do what he'd agreed. He didn't want to pay the money. He didn't want to lose his land for the legal services. He didn't dispute the value of the legal services. So he used the file as a wedge to try to get this to happen, I guess, you know, to try to get away from having that. He wanted to keep that piece of property. I think he thought it had some appreciation potential. It's down in Tana County near the lake. I think that's what it was. But he didn't. The pledge agreement came due on August 1st. The bar complaint was filed on August 15th. The certified letter was sent from a hotel in Las Vegas on July 15th. We didn't have a phone number that worked. We had one where the voicemail never answered. We didn't have an address to send the file to. There was nothing else that could have been done. That file sat at the office And I think it's Anissa's fiduciary duty to hold on to that file until somebody actually comes to get it. She couldn't mail it to that hotel in Las Vegas because she didn't know if Mr. Dunn was going to be there or not. And because he never came to get it, it took him 6 months to come and get it. Instead of coming to get his file, he sent certified letters from Las Vegas. He could make it to Las Vegas, but he couldn't make it to Ozark, Missouri.
Does OCDC say there was a permanent address that could have been mailed to, or what's there?
I am unaware of any permanent address that has been provided. I'd like to hear that myself. I think that's a question for them. Is what could Anissa have done differently? And I don't know the answer to that.
Is there any suggestion that your client herself requested money as opposed to the associate?
The associate created that bill, and when Anissa found out about it, she retracted that bill and wiped it off. So the bill went up to 12 grand almost, and then back down to 9 and change. And that's also part of the record.
On Rule 5.1 and 5.2, the owner of the firm, the partner, is responsible for any conduct by the people that work for them.
Correct. That's why she stood tall and she wiped out that bill and said, you don't have to pay it. And again, offered that file up. You know, that file was ready at all points. I think the file was requested on February 27. They said, we need a couple days to get it together. You can have it on March 1st or March 2nd. I don't have my timeline in front of me. Then on July 15th, nothing happened except some phone calls were made, which no response was made. Then on July 15, Mr. Dunn sends his certified letter from Las Vegas. Then on August 15th, the bar complaint's made. Only in September does Mr. Dunn finally send his father to pick up the file. So
did the OCDC contact, as was indicated by Mr. Pope, did the OCDC contact your client to say turn over the file, or did that have to happen at all?
I'm unaware of that, and that call would have been unnecessary because that file was waiting for him to pick it up. All he had to do was walk in the door and say, I'd like my file.
He picked it up how long after the complaint was filed? It was filed August 15th, and he picked it up in September?
He never picked it up. He sent his father.
He picked it up through his father.
I think 9/11 is the date in my head without my tablet battery's dead. So I can't tell you the exact, but I believe it was 9/11.
Okay.
The letters and the affidavit and the other correspondence in your appendix, that was all submitted in the hearing to the panel?
That, I believe, is part of the disciplinary file. I do not believe, well, no, I think actually that some were and some weren't, Judge. You may have to be more specific.
Well, are we to consider any of it that wasn't? Let me ask it that way.
Well, this is a de novo review
of what was presented to during the hearing, right?
What's our record made up of?
I believe that it's proper for the administrative, for the pleadings and the administrative record, and the reason that those letters are in the appendix is they were part of our response to OCDC's inquiry.
So they would have been available to the hearing, Commissioner. If they were part of the pleadings, they have the pleadings.
Right, and I think that they have the responses as well, is my understanding.
According to Rule 519, the record is as though on an original writ proceeding, as opposed to an appeal, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
Anything further?
Well, I would say that with regard to count two, I think the standard is that she has to do what's reasonably practical. And if you don't have an address and your phone number just rings and rings, leaving the file at the office for the guy to come get it, that's the only thing you can do. I don't think that there's any obligation to hire a PI to find the guy. I think that's not reasonably practical.
So that evidence was before the hearing commission.
Well, no PIs were hired.
No, I mean the evidence that you tried to get it back to them, but you couldn't find them.
It starts with a returned letter on January 25th, and then there's some phone calls where he requested the file on the 27th of February. The file was made available to him at the very beginning of March, which was just 1 or 2
days. And that was in front of the fact finder.
That's all there, yes. That's all there. There's even an exhibit that has that all there. We have the documentation from the CLIO system is also in the appendix. And that actually, that brings me to a point of, I don't know what a lawyer's to do if she can't document or file about what she's doing. And in the hearing panel, they never even, they completely omitted all the efforts that we had to return the file. So I don't know what a lawyer's to do other than to document or file and to do her best to get it back. And if she, if the only phone number she has is for a phone that nobody answers, and the only address she has is for a hotel in Las Vegas, I don't think there's anything she can do.
They didn't make any detailed findings in the panel, but they just said respondent's guilty of professional misconduct for failing to surrender papers and property within a reasonable time. Do we know any? We have no other information about what they
did. Well, I was very shocked to see that because I put on hours of testimony. Mr. Dunn agreed that he never came to get his file. ANISA's secretary, Kate Mingwasser, testified that the file was there at all pertinent times with the exception of a couple of days around when it was copied and that errant bill was sent out, the bill that was retracted. So,
do the rules of the procedure apply? Could you ask for, on a Rule 73 point, I guess 1-2, ask for findings of fact and conclusions of law?
I did not ask, no.
Could you have?
Heck if I know. I don't know. It's usually my luck asking for written findings from most judges has not been good. I'd be unlikely to try to do it again.
Do the civil rules apply in OCDC proceedings?
That's my understanding. Yes.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Phillips, what's the basis for the claim that she didn't make the file available timely? It was simply, he says, that there's no evidence to counter the evidence that he presented that it was waiting since March.
Right. The Mr. Dunn, the client, testified that he didn't get any calls from them.
But he said, but they say there's no telephone number or address they could reach. Is that incorrect?
It is. The record indicates that the secretary that testified for the respondent, not the one that complained.
Can you speak up a little?
Yes, I'm sorry. The secretary who testified for the respondent said that they had the two phone numbers and an address since February 6th or so. And they were using that, and they used that address during the time period in March and then another time to send out invoices. So they were.
And do we know that was a correct address and was would have reached the person?
Yes.
I mean,
there's no indication that it wasn't right.
You wouldn't want to send a file to some place that you weren't sure they were there. So
exactly.
Do we know later on it turned out that was a correct address?
Well, to that point, it would have been easy to send a letter to this person if they knew, if they had a phone that wasn't working, they could have tried the other phone or sent a letter saying, come get your file. There's no letters to that.
Was there any testimony concerning whether or not the invoices were returned?
There is not.
Do you think that supports the finding?
I think right. Mr. Dunn said he didn't get these calls. And their record, their own records, this list that they're talking about, shows no effort after these two calls that were with unreturned, were unable to leave a voice message.
Did Mr. Dunn testify whether or not he received the invoices that they mailed to him?
He didn't testify about the invoices.
He did or did not?
I'm sorry. To my recollection, he did not testify about the invoices one way or the other. Now, what happened in July was that Mr. Dunn filed a motion. He was pro se at the time. He filed a motion in the court asking the court to order a respondent to give him his file back. The court said, I don't know that I have the authority to do that. What he did also was, Mr. Dunn, that is to send a copy by certified mail to the respondent. July 15th or so, she received that. She did nothing all through the rest of July until middle of August when she got a copy of a complaint from our office. And at that point, then they made arrangements to return the file. Although even when it was returned, it wasn't all returned. When it was returned, there were parts missing. If And according to the secretary also, Anissa, the respondent, Anissa is what she was referred to in the transcript, prepares the bills, completes and approves all of outgoing bills.
Anything further?
Nothing else.
All right. Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement.